Welcome to the Aquarimax Audio Show with Russ and Kelly. We provide information on all kinds of aquarium-related topics.
This is episode 88, recorded November 14th, 2011.
Greetings, everyone.
Hello.
Drum roll, please.
Oh, okay. Hang on.
Okay, we have...
What are we drum rolling for?
An announcement.
A nice announcement.
It's a cool thing that's going on.
I won't sing the announcement song.
No, I don't know. This is for Aquatics Live.
In the UK. This is for our UK listeners. Well, and
anybody else who might want to go.
Sort of closer to there than we are.
Yeah. Because in London, in just a few short days, in fact, starting on the 19th and going into the 20th, so those 2 days, Aquatics Live is a fish-keeping consumer show.
So it's like
got everything.
An expo.
Yeah.
Fair
for,
kind of thing?
For consumers.
That people can go to and buy groovy fishy stuff. Is that basically kind of what it is?
Yeah. They've
it's a
got
fish expo.
Seminars, interactive areas, shopping opportunities, displays.
So it's like an expo / conference.
Yeah, something
Neat.
Like that. And one of the people who are setting it up. What's the word I'm looking for? I'm fishing for a word here. It's just
executive-y people-y types.
One of the organizers.
Oh, yes. There we go.
Contacted us and asked us to give a bit of a shout out for Aquatics Live, so that's what we're doing. So, Sarah, here you go. We have done it. We hope you all check it out, but we're going to give you some information so you can check it out. You need that. It is www.aquatics-live.com. Okay, mm-hmm. You can check that out. Or you can go to Facebook.com/ Aquatics Live, and the A in Aquatics and the L in Live are capital, and there's no space there for the Facebook page. Mm-hmm. So you can check that out and find out a little bit more about it. But if you're going to be anywhere near London, November 19th and 20th.
Yeah, if any of you get down there, you should, you know, give us a review of how it was, and if you found anything, any good deals or spooky
critters. Tell us what you found out.
You
know, so tell us what you saw, tell us what you liked. That would be fun.
Pictures.
Right. So, Aquatics Live. There you go.
Alrighty. Now, this is just kind of a funny little tidbit. We took a look at who's listening to us.
Yes.
And we're kind of surprised, actually, of where most of our listenership is.
Yes. It had been a while since I'd looked at the stats of where most of our listeners were coming from, and this is funny. Not funny in a bad way, just interesting.
Just like, oh, wow, I wouldn't have suspected that.
Now, most of our listeners are in the USA, and that's not really a surprise, I suppose.
Mm-hmm.
But then, the second largest country in terms of listenership is actually...
in Russia.
Go figure. That's cool. So,
but we haven't heard from anybody in Russia, so you faithful listeners in Russia,
send us
some
an
questions
email or something.
Or
that
some
would be
comments.
Cool. We'd love to hear from you. And then the next largest country in terms of listenership is Algeria.
Also a little bit of a surprise.
Yeah.
And we also haven't heard from any of you, so,
we'd love to.
Drop us a line.
Right. And after Algeria, there's the UK.
And you said 31 different cities?
31 different cities in terms of the week that I looked at that people had accessed our websites from 31 different cities in the UK. So we've got quite a few listeners there as well. Not as many as Russia and Algeria, but... quite a few.
Mm-hmm.
And then...
so the next was Canada.
And then Australia.
Yeah.
And we are not forgetting our faithful listeners in other countries. We know we have some sprinkled around in various other countries too, like France and Trinidad and so on. Mm-hmm. But we were just interested to find out the demographics a bit of our listeners. And so we...
That's interesting.
Commend you all for listening and grateful that you do. So please keep doing it and please keep contacting us.
Mm-hmm. Andreka sent us a comment this week. Andreka from Oregon.
She was looking at our try-ups video on YouTube, the one we most recently released. And
what did she have to say to us?
Just, I can't remember her exact wording right now. I should have written it down. But basically, she just thought it was a bizarre creature in an interesting way. You know, she wasn't negative about it. She just said,
I've
never seen anything like that before.
They're pretty bizarre.
They are bizarre, yes.
They look like something in a sci-fi movie.
They do. And so we thought it would be fun to talk a little bit about the try-ups that I mentioned last week, how they were hatching in water that had a fairly high mineral content.
Yeah, you hadn't changed it out to hatch the
since
eggs.
Since the other ones had passed on.
Water.
They were just, they started to hatch. I was getting ready to take the tank down, and I looked in there and saw there were triops in there, babies. And now there are several juveniles. Some of them are like half an inch or more long now, probably close to an inch now. Just swimming around and doing fine, which is pretty amazing. Didn't expect that. Without having to, you know, do the whole thing. And I knew that triops could hatch sometimes without drying, that some of the eggs would hatch without drying, but I did not suspect that some of them would hatch with such a high mineral content in the water. So that's kind of interesting.
We're not quite sure why that happened.
No, but I suppose, you know, there are various eggs in various stages because they tend to release some eggs that will hatch after being moistened and dried more than once. They have to dry and then be wet and then dry and then be wet several times before they will hatch, and they have others that will hatch, a certain proportion of them or a certain percentage that will hatch without drying. So
they just kind of try to cover all their bases, so
yeah,
to speak.
Yeah, it's a way to cover all their bases so that if they have a really wet season or several very dry seasons, they'll still have some dry-ups once things settle down enough.
That's why they're still around.
Yep, very much survivors. So I guess I shouldn't be all that surprised. But we thought it would be fun, if anybody is interested in keeping triops and hasn't done so, that we could do a giveaway and just give some eggs away.
It's been a while since we've done a giveaway, so we thought it's about time.
And 88's kind of a cool number.
Yeah, because, you know, it's 8 and 8.
Exactly. So we thought that if we could get someone to listen to the episode 23, which is the episode on triops, that shouldn't be too hard, and then tell us something interesting from the episode and give us a time signature on
that
it.
So happened at
like 17 minutes and 4 seconds or something, and tell us what it was. If they would do that and then send us an email indicating that they have done so, the first person to do so could receive some triops that are descended from our triops.
In egg form.
Yes. Yeah, in egg form, of course. Dry, mixed with sand, and then they can hatch them. Because, of course,
they seem
having
to be pretty hardy triops this strain. So.
And they're fun. They're a good one. And if by listening to our podcast, episode 23, on triops, they will be prepared to take care of them, make sure they have everything they need, then we can do that. So that'd be fun.
So, if you want triops, go listen to episode 23. Find something interesting or something, you know, quote or whatever, and the time signature that it happened at, and email it to us. And if you're the first one, then we will send you some triops eggs.
Yeah, that would be cool. Okay.
What do we have next? Oh, we have another comment from Randall.
In Utah.
In Utah, yes. And Randall is from Utah.
Yes, and he said that he tried feeding peas, as we mentioned before, on the last episode. But he said one interesting thing that he has noted, kind of a side benefit, is that he's found it more interesting to watch the fish eat. Everybody becomes more involved in watching the fish eat when they're eating peas. It's not just like sprinkling flakes on the surface.
Mm-hmm.
It's just more interesting to watch them become interested. And he said, for example, the Plecostomus, who doesn't seem terribly interested in the flakes or in much of anything that's going on most of the time, is very interested when the peas get dropped in there. And so I suggested he try a green bean.
Oh, they like those.
They like those, too.
The Plecostomus chocolate.
But I thought that was an interesting point, just saying that it was a more interesting experience feeding the fish when they tried something else like that. So I'm glad he brought that up.
A little bit more natural behavior, I would imagine.
Right. Since fish like silver dollars and so on tend to eat a lot of vegetable matter, and not so much in terms of dried flakes in the wild.
Yeah, you don't get a whole lot of dried flakes in the wild.
No, not so much.
Not even sinking pellets.
No, that's true as well. Unless someone's chumming with them, I guess.
I guess.
But, okay, I think let's move on to our next commenter, contributor for the day.
We have a nice long email from Brian in Idaho.
Brian in Idaho, yep. And Brian is a biologist by trade with
We've had him on the show.
We've had him on the show,
yes.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. He did a show on keeping nano reefs for us when we interviewed him and so on. And he's been a contributor for a long time.
Oh, and he sends good stuff.
He does. And in fact, we've done two shows with him because we did one on
his outdoor
cycling with different things with plants and so on, different things like that.
Okay.
Yep. So we've done
been
a couple
while,
of shows.
Sorry.
No, it's been a while. It's true. Anyway, being a biologist with an emphasis on aquatic biology, he had some good comments to that related to what Mick had mentioned in last week's episode.
We had a little bit of discussion about salt. He was talking about using. Was it dishwasher or laundry salt?
Dishwashing salt, I believe it was called.
Dishwashing salt.
Yes.
Which we didn't really exactly know what that was, because I don't know that that's something that's really widely available over here.
Right, not that widely used. And so we looked up and found out a bit about it, but...
not too much.
Brian would mention, he wanted to mention something, because we did find out that it is very pure salt. In
pure
terms
salt,
of
meaning like
sodium chloride. Okay. Yeah, sodium chloride. Well, Brian wanted to point out something about that, because it is just sodium chloride, that when you use a hydrometer, it measures the total specific gravity / salinity of the water.
Now, is salinity and specific gravity the same thing?
Well, not exactly.
Maybe you can break that down for us non-chemistry people.
Well, I can try to do that. Basically, salinity is measured in terms of parts per thousand, usually. And seawater is around 35 parts per thousand. So every thousand parts of water, there's 35 parts of the salt in the water.
Okay.
Something like that. And then specific gravity is really density. It's measured in terms of density. So pure water is considered, if you take a unit of water, specific gravity, if it's pure water, is 1.000, is usually how it's measured. And then salt water at marine strength, or seawater strength, is about 1.025 or so, depending on the temperature, right around there. So, because you're measuring density, it changes based on temperature. But the salinity doesn't change based on temperature. So, hopefully that helps. Does it?
We'll just move on.
Okay. Well, anyway, most of the...
You guys have questions about it, you can ask. I probably wouldn't even know what to ask.
A lot of the hydrometers measure both. I think most of them do. The one I have does. Measures both.
And it gives you two different readings?
Yeah, but you do have to pay careful attention to the temperature when you're reading. You know, most of them say you have to be measuring water within these temperature ranges. And there are different ways to convert that and so on, but... Anyway, usually the ones I have, at least, and have had, you need to be measuring within a certain temperature range. Because of that, if you're talking about specific, if you're talking about the specific gravity, and that's what you're measuring, that's what you need to worry about. You need to think about that. But anyway, he was saying that there is, because there's just sodium chloride in the dishwashing salt, and because in natural seawater or synthetic seawater that's been mixed to, you know, mimic seawater in terms of its chemical composition, it has a lot of different things in it. It's got calcium, potassium.
It doesn't have just sodium chloride.
It's got magnesium ions, and it's got all these other different things in it, both in terms of the major components of the ions that are in there and then the trace elements. It's got all these different things that the pure sodium chloride doesn't have. And so biologically, these different elements are required by organisms that live in these waters.
Basically, they need trace elements.
They need trace elements, and they need these other major ions that are not as common in a water sample, if you will, as sodium chloride, but they're still necessary. Brian also included a link to an Instant Ocean PDF that explains all of that, so we'll put that on the resources page. And he said there's a couple of reasons why these ions and so on are needed in addition to the sodium chloride. And one of them is that invertebrates need iodine in trace amounts to be able to molt, which we learned when we were keeping hermit crabs. It's very important for them to get enough iodine for their molting process to work properly. And this is not such a difficulty if you're using a marine salt mix, which has some iodine in it, in trace amounts, and so if you're changing the water regularly, they're getting enough as we learned with our marine hermit crabs, they didn't really have problems molting because we were regularly changing water. With terrestrial hermit crabs, if they don't get it in their diet, then they're in trouble. Mm-hmm. So that would be one example of that.
Before we go any further, I think it's time for the break.
Ah, indeed.
This isn't a commercial, because it's not trying to sell you anything. It is, however, the part where we shamelessly encourage you to be a part of the Aquarimax audio show by calling and leaving a message any time of the day or night at 801-477-0629. If you don't want to actually talk, but you do have a comment or question, you can just send us an email to info@aquarimax.com. There. That wasn't so painful.
So, iodine is just an example of one of those trace elements that is necessary. So, that is a point in favor of using just the normal synthetic salt mix, even for brackish organisms, because they need those as well. Another reason why these substances are important is their buffering capacity. Certain of these other substances in the water will help keep the pH stable, while sodium chloride by itself does not. So that can be, you know, an extremely important part of keeping fish healthy, is keeping the pH stable. And of course, you know, I don't think Brian's suggesting at all that Mick, there's any problem with using this to hatch brine shrimp or anything like that.
Is that what Mick was using
it for? And he was using it for that, but he was also using it for other things, yes.
Okay.
For brine shrimp, when you're hatching them, the purpose is not raising them up to adulthood or anything in general.
Yes, if you're just going to feed them.
Right. So I don't think that's a problem at all. He was just saying that basically, when with your fish, even though they are very, brackish water fish particularly, are very adept at handling these fluctuating salinity levels, and that's good. I think one point that Brian wanted to make was just that the sodium chloride, because when you use the hydrometer, you're reading the sodium chloride, but you're not reading all those other
salts. It doesn't tell you if they're getting all the other little things that they need.
That and the fact that the reading is going to show a different reading than it would if you were using a synthetic salt mix that had all the different types of salts that were needed. So, if you get, let's say, a specific gravity reading at 75 degrees of 1.016 just using dishwashing salt,
mm-hmm.
and you get the same reading in a different sample of water that's used a synthetic salt mix that's made for marine tanks, that in the one with the dishwashing salt in it, it's going to have a higher proportion of sodium chloride to reach that same reading.
Like you have to put more in to get that to that reading, basically?
Right, because the other salts aren't there doing their part.
So maybe the fish are getting too much salt?
So it could be possible for the fish to get more sodium chloride than they really need, and that because that is making up part of that reading. You know what I'm saying?
Uh-huh.
If that makes sense. So even though the fish may be able to handle it, it could cause them some physiological stress because their body is basically working harder to pump out that sodium chloride to maintain their normal blood levels, and it would be harder on invertebrates. And I imagine it depends on the salinity, too. Of some fish that you're just putting a really low level of salinity in there, it may not be a big deal, but it probably is for others, and the higher salinity you get, the more difficult it is to make sure that it's balanced. So in sum, I think basically what Brian wants to drive home this point is that though the dishwashing salt can be very useful in a lot of aquarium applications, like hatching brine shrimp,
mm-hmm.
Probably for reducing nitrate toxicity when you're cycling or things like that, or to reduce osmotic pressure in certain cases, that can be helpful when you're treating fish with certain conditions, things like that. Very useful in many ways, that when you're trying to create a long-term healthy environment for brackish water fish, the best way to go is probably a synthetic mix intended for marine tanks, just because you're going to get all of those healthy ions
mm-hmm.
that they're really used to that they need for long-term health. So I think that's probably a summary of what that entails.
So thank you, Brian, for bringing it up.
Yep. And now, we had kind of a fun find the other day.
Tell us our fun find.
We found a hex tank at a garage
Ooh,
sale.
Ooh, yes. Guess how much? Guess. I'm excited. I love to not pay very much for stuff. I
frugality is a virtue of yours.
Yes.
Yes.
So, guess how much? I'm listening. I can't hear you, though. Are you guessing? Okay. Tell them exactly what we got, and then they can guess again.
Okay. We got a hex tank that was, I think it's a 29-gallon hex tank, based on my calculations, somewhere between 27 and 29, I think 29, and a wrought iron stand that was built to accommodate
stand.
It. Yeah, it's a very nice one. So we got both of those.
For $15!
So not bad.
Garage sale.
Yeah, not bad. And it holds water.
Yes, we tested.
Which is rather important. Yeah.
We were very excited because our 5-year-old wants her own tank for Christmas, and so there we go. That's really cheap Christmas present.
Not a bad find. So we were able to get it home, and incidentally, we had to enlist some help to get it home because we were out of town when we got it, when we saw it at the garage sale.
We didn't have room in the car.
We didn't have room in the car at the time, so we bought it, paid them the money, and said, we'll arrange some way to get it back, to get it, come pick it up.
$15, how can you just let that sit there on the side of the road, languishing, waiting for someone to give it home?
Especially since our daughter had been wanting her own tank. So, we arranged finally to get it home. We got it home a few days ago and filled it up and tested it and so on. But it was interesting because you don't always think about this, but when you have a non-initiate to the aquarium world and they need to move an aquarium like that, even when it's empty, some important things. So our kind-hearted helpers, we reminded them to remove all the gravel first.
So these are also, you know, some beginner tips for how to move a fish tank successfully.
Yes, if you're ever going to move a fish tank of any sort, it's always best to take as much as you can out of it. Water, gravel, anything. A lot of people try to move it with a couple inches of gravel in it, but that...
It's heavy.
Well, it's heavy, and it can also spell disaster for the aquarium itself. You really should move it when it's as empty as you can possibly manage. And then, also, especially with a hex tank and with its shape and so on, not to pick it up at the top, because you can really ruin it. You can break the seal in the silicone, or you can just crack the tank if you pick it up from the top.
Bad.
So we instructed them on how to pick it up properly and so on.
So how do you pick it up properly?
Well, from the base.
Okay.
And very carefully.
Not from the middle?
No.
Just from the base.
Just from the base. And the frame of the base.
Okay.
You don't put your hand under the glass and push there, because that's not where it's strongest. It's strongest on the frame. So, had them do that. They got it up here just fine. And so now we're set up.
Oh, the other thing you said to do when you're transporting it in a car, don't lay it on its side.
Right.
In a rectangular tank, you probably wouldn't do that anyways, just
because
of the way you put it down.
But a hex tank, being taller than it is wide, I just reminded them not to set it on its side because we're putting undue pressure on that one pane and so on. Not a good idea.
Now, the rectangular tanks, if you were trying to fit more than one thing in the car, do you also want to avoid laying that on the shorter side there? Or do you want it to just sit like it would sit on a stand?
I would sit it how it would sit on a stand because it's going to be most resilient in that position.
Okay.
Yes. So... We're very excited about that. And this is the interesting thing. She wants a betta.
She does want a betta.
And that's great, because I think it'll be great for a betta to have such a large tank.
It'll be a happy betta.
Yes, and we might put, you know, a bristlenose placo in there or something, too, to keep it company and to help, you know, keep the sides relatively algae-free and so on. We're trying to decide exactly how we want to set it up, what we're going to do in terms of filtration, that sort of thing. But it'll be interesting. And we've taken her to the stores to look at a couple of bettas, and she always says, oh, I want that one, and I'm not going to change my mind. And then 1 minute later, oh, I want that one, and I'm not going to change my mind. She's been very...
She's five.
Yes, which, you know, that's totally understandable. But we are hoping that she'll choose one that's kind of a nice one. My personal favorites include placats, the naturally short-tailed ones, They don't have the long flowing fins that many of them have. But I also love half moons. Those are one of my favorites as well. Delta tails are nice. The rose tails look really nice too.
I mean, haven't seen a rose
there's
tail
so many, so many kinds. It's sort of like there are tips of the tails that keep growing. It's hard to describe. They're sort of scalloped tails.
Can we get a picture?
Yeah, we could probably do that. We'll see if we can find a picture.
Find a copyright-free picture and put it on the resource page.
We can try, or at least a link to one or something.
Yeah, a link is good.
Yeah, there are so many fascinating types. I think I really like almost all of them, except I'm not particularly partial to veil tails, although I've had some beautiful veil tails and have great memories with veil tails. But if I had to pick one just based on physical appearance, I would probably choose a non-veil tail. But what would you say?
Is it called butterfly with the white around the fins?
Often, yes.
I like those in just like either the delta or the half moons.
Mm-hmm.
I don't like the double tails. I think it looks like a butt.
Well, I need to show you a high-quality double tail.
Well, then it would just be a high-quality butt.
Because we did see some in the store the
other
day.
I had to say something goofy. I hadn't really said something goofy this whole time, okay. And people were probably thinking I was asleep
I'll give you that. But the thing is, when you go to a lot of the stores, in some of the big box stores, I won't mention any particular names, but we...
But they all start with pet.
Okay.
We won't mention the second half of their name.
Okay. When they have the betas of different types, like the double tails or the half moons and so on, most of those are culls.
I know.
And so...
They're culled butts.
Yes, their quality is not as high as it would be if you would get one, online from a breeder or something like that. But we do have a pet store, our local fish store, Fish For You, which I will mention by name.
Because we like them.
If anybody from around here is listening, they should go there. It is a great store, and they have some really nice bettas that they get in. We're not talking culls
here. No,
they're good. They're maybe not the top-of-the-line breeder showfish, but they're several steps above the ones you'll find in the big box stores.
They do not resemble a rear end in any way.
Right, and they have some really nice ones. Anything from black orchid crown tails to opaque white placots and all kinds of fun stuff.
Yeah, they get some good stuff in.
So maybe we can get her to get one of those.
Maybe so.
Yeah. Or maybe she'll just pick a veil tail and it'll be great because it'll be her pet and she'll love it. Thank you for listening to this edition of the Aquarimax Audio Show. For additional episodes, please visit aquarimax.com. For comments and or questions that may be featured on an upcoming podcast, leave a message at 801-477-0629 or email us at info@aquarimax.com.